And let us look at the quiz. This quiz had a lot of typos on it, causing me to drop entire questions. I am very sorry for all the stress that probably caused all of you as well. But let's talk about what we've got. First, we talk about what the compare and set instruction actually looks like. The lock comp exchange assembly instruction in x86. What this does is it gets a one register and one memory address, and it copies that register into the memory address if the memory address currently stores the same thing as an EAX. So the question is, how do we know if it succeeded? So the correct way to do this is we compare EAX and EDX. Okay, if this worked, if we have success, then we will have copied EDX into the memory address. And they will be distinct. They will be different if we modified the value, right? If we so if we have successfully run this, then EAX and EDX will have different values. If we have not successfully run it, then they will have the same value. So comparing and trying again, if they are the same, will work. We could also, and a lot of you thought about, well, why don't we just go to memory and see if the value made it into memory? The trick here is compare is not atomic. And other instructions could have occurred between the compare exchange and this that could have changed the contents of memory. So some other thread may have, between our checking and this instruction being run, changed the value in memory, so that memory could now have a different value in general. And so this will work if no other thread has modified memory, but if we weren't worried about other threads modifying memory, we wouldn't have been doing a compare and set atomically anyway. So this is a reasonable guess, but it won't quite work. We also had others that compared different things to memory, right? So this one is the other direction of comparing, fails for the same reason. There is a chance that we might have something else go on in between. So that was question one. Question says EDX could be changed as well. Yes, EDX means you don't have to use EDX, but we are using EDX here. Was there another reading of that? I mean, EDX can be changed. I guess you could read that as saying some other code can change EDX, but as we talked about, other threads can't modify EDX. It can't be modified by other threads, so we would still be able to guarantee the EDX hadn't been changed by our thread. Because each thread has its own copy of all of the registers. Other questions about question one? Sure, if there is code in between the lock compare exchange and our checking, anything could have changed. Right? So there's no way, I mean, like, if I say arbitrary code can go in between, then the answer is we have no way of knowing what code will work. We could have moved values all around arbitrarily. Can I explain it again? Sure. I will explain it again. So compare exchange will, if EAX is the value currently stored in memory, change what's stored in memory to be EDX. Otherwise, it will change EAX to be EDX. So one of two values will get the value of EDX, either the value stored in memory or EAX. It'll be the value stored in memory if EAX and the memory were the same, otherwise it will be EAX. So we need to check to see if this ran successfully. We, in theory, could check EAX in memory, memory in EDX, or EAX in EDX. Any pair of those three, in theory, could work. However, working with memory won't work because memory is not atomic. Other threads could modify memory. And so between running this and running our check, some other thread could have modified memory. So we need to check a pair of registers. The pair of registers we can check are these two, because they are the two registers that potentially have been modified. They will be the same, they will be equal if we failed. They will be non-equal if we succeeded. And so we check the registers, and if they were equal, we know that the compare and set failed to set. Explain which of the values represents which part of the lock. There is not actually a lock here. This is an atomic compare and set instruction. So we aren't locking anything. We are changing the value stored in memory to this value if the value stored in memory is currently the same as EAX. So we're comparing EAX and memory, and if they are the same, then we are setting memory to EDX, all together atomically in one step. Other questions? What happens if EAX and EDX have the same value on the first run, but EAX does not equal star memory? So if EAX and EDX have same value at the same run, then it would look like we had failed, because it would look like we end up with the same value. And it will look like that either way. There's no way of checking if that was the case. Typically, the most common use of this is to load a value into memory into EAX, and then later use this compare exchange. We wouldn't do that if we hadn't changed memory as the understanding Intel had. But you're right, we wouldn't be able to say anything in that particular case. If EAX and EDX were the same, then this instruction won't do what we would normally want it to happen. But by construction, we will generally write code where that isn't the case. So that's the scenario you didn't select the answer. Well, in that case, none of the other answers would be correct either, for the same reasoning. Right, because I can't, again, other threads could have modified memory, so I can't compare anything to memory to tell if it worked. Hopefully you wrote some comments associated with your question if you have found this confusing, and we'll be able to look at that and potentially award partial credit. Okay. Then we had these questions, which unfortunately, almost every single item in them had a typo, So you'll notice I just dropped question 2 and 3 because of the typo. I have this setting, I have double a couple of times, but other places I'm acting like it's an int, and some of the answers only work if it's an int, and there are just lots of typos here. I sincerely apologize for the headache that must unavoidably have caused, as witnessed in part by the almost random answer situation here. So I have marked correct if it actually is correct in this case, or accepted any answer if you can argue either way. We will see what we can do here. So the one that we could basically say something is still useful here is, does the caller have to clean up? The caller only has to clean up if the return value was malloced. And so this was the only question that sort of survived. Let me talk a little bit about what the intent was, even though it isn't actually applicable in this case. If I had said this was an int and done int consistently throughout, we can simply cast an int to avoid. We can simply cast the int to avoid star. We can cast between integers and pointers without changing any bits. So we could just cast as avoid star to get it back. Reason we can't, in general, just cast an address of it back is because we declared it as a local variable. So it will be on the callee's stack, which will have been popped by the time the caller comes around. So this is not a wise thing to do. This is one of those things that will work sometimes and not others, depending on how your compiler has decided to allocate the stack and whether the value still is there or not, making some of the weirdest kind of bugs. And then mallocing, if we had mallocked the right type of value, would work, but means that the caller has to clean up afterwards. However, the question had some really serious typos, which is why it basically got dropped. Questions about these questions or the concepts behind them for question 4? Interpreted cleanup is recasting back to a double. That's not, by cleanup we usually mean take out the garbage, but I realize we may not have formalized that generally. I mean, all of these you will have to do some there will have to be some assembly code to deal with the fact a value is somewhere. And casting won't actually be one of those. The assembly won't need to cast. You'll just treat the value as a different type. But I don't know. I'm not going to make a decision about what to do that right now. I will think about that and see if I think there's reason for partial credit there, or we may drop even that part too. Although I don't think that the bug in the question matters in that particular instance for this one. I'll think about that. Other questions about these? Sorry, let me just clarify. Casting between pointers and integers is not an assembly instruction. It's a type system that C does only. So in the assembled code, there won't be casts. They will just treat the register as storing different kinds of values, which doesn't necessarily mean there isn't work for the programmer to do, even if there isn't work for the computer to do. But yeah, I can see how the wording even there was a little bit ambiguous. This quiz did not go the way I'd hoped. All right, then we have a couple questions about what is the right synchronization primitive. The first one we were doing pretty well. If we want to parallelize animation drawing program by dividing the screen into four parts, having each run separately, and then I display it. This is a classic example of what a barrier is good for. Each of the threads goes and does their stuff. Then we put a barrier at the end of whatever their stuff is so that they all finish drawing their part of the screen before we display it, and then spin off the threads on the next screen. Okay, so this is a traditional model of how barriers are. And there were just a handful of you that answered others. Let me just briefly comment about the spawning threads, letting them run to completion and joining them all. I gave partial credit for that, because you could imagine spawning a new set of four threads for each frame instead of reusing the same ones. And that is effectively sort of spawning a new set of threads each time or using a barrier are equivalent operations. Just the barrier is a lot faster. It doesn't have the overhead of creating and destroying the threads. And so we could do this. It'd be more overhead. It's not as good, but has the same general effect. Question six, we were a lot less unified on. If I have hundreds of small tasks, I want them to run quickly by having four threads work on the task. And as each thread finishes a task, it should pick another task to work on. Some of the tasks take more work than others, and I can't tell how long each one will take until it starts working them, and I've got an array of values. Okay, what should we do? Well, what we want to do is we want each thread to atomically grab a task and start working on it. Okay, and so we want to have each, we sort of want this, some probably want some sort of counter or some other way of checking out which is the next undone task. And when we grab an undone task, we want to sort of make sure no other thread grabs it as well. So a mutex around the thread claims a task is a simple and correct solution. There is a way to do this with an atomic compare and set operation, where we have a pointer that points to the next available task and do some atomic compare and set to make that work along the way. It's a little tricky to get that exactly right. I'm seeing a lot of strange things in the chat. All right, so we can do these sorts of things, but those are sort of the ones that work reasonably. A reader-writer lock, we can use reader-writer lock anytime we use a mutex. We don't really have distinct reading and writing activities here to get to tasks. Each task should be read and written only by one thread, and the one piece of information they all need to read, which is what task we're on, they need to write every time they read. So mutexes work better than a sort of more natural fit there. Spawning threads and let them run to completion is a very popular answer here. If I were to spawn a different thread for everything, well, first off, I'm not spawning four of them. And And if I try to pre-allocate the tasks out into the four different threads, because they take dramatically different times and don't work the same amount of time, that's going to be a very inefficient solution as well. So the locking, grabbing a task is the correct way of going about this. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Interpret the question and say, wanting to run the thread simultaneously, thought the mutexes and compare and set would prevent that from happening. Okay, this is a good point. We don't want to make a mutex around the entire task. We only need to make the mutex around the I claim a task. Okay, so if we were to say we're gonna lock the entire task, there's no parallelism, but there's no reason to do that. All thread one needs to lock is claiming the first task. All thread two needs to lock is claiming the second task. And once one finishes a task, all it needs to lock is the process of claiming the next task in line. And so they can lock, claim, unlock, and then spend all of their time working on the task that they uniquely have without any synchronization. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Today, we are going to continue our conversation about deadlock. We started this a little bit last time because we finished reasonably early with rollback. And so we're going to dive into deadlock a little bit more and talk about how we deal with this. In particular, this is something that operating systems need to think about, because if they get in a deadlock, everything breaks. But all kinds of concurrent code that has locks needs to worry about deadlock. As a reminder, we talked about the necessary conditions, mutual exclusion, hold and wait, non-preemption, and circular wait last time, and sort of how those worked. And we talked about the exact detection algorithm. We're going to say a little bit more about this resource allocation graph today. I'll come back to that here in a moment. We also talked about heuristic, the basic idea that says if everything is waiting, probably something is deadlocked. And so today we're going to talk about how to recover when we notice there's a deadlock and how to prevent them from ever happening in the first place. So to do that, let's consider a resource allocation graph. I'm going to use A to represent an agent and R to represent a resource. I'm going to talk about a classic resource problem called the Dining Philosopher's Problem. This will also be the content of your lab tomorrow. The idea of the dining philosopher's problem is we imagine our agents are sitting around a table together, and they each have a plate of spaghetti they want to eat. I don't know why it's always spaghetti, but it always is spaghetti. And they each have, there's a chopstick between every pair of agents. Just one. So what an agent needs to do is grab both chopsticks, one on each side, eat some spaghetti, and then put the chopsticks back down so somebody else can use them. This is clearly not a very sanitary way of going about eating, but this is the concept behind the dining philosopher's problem. The way we write our resource allocation graph is we draw arrows between agents and resources, and the direction of the arrow tells us something important. An arrow from resource to agent means the agent has the resource. So if I draw an arrow from a resource to an agent, that means that that resource is owned by the agent. That agent has grabbed that resource. If I draw an arrow instead from an agent to a resource, instead of from a resource to an agent, that means the agent is waiting for the resource. It wants the resource, doesn't have the resource, and will wait until it becomes available. This is the idea of the resource allocation graph. And deadlock occurs when there is actually, I should probably make these. There is a cycle in that graph. If I have a cycle in my resource allocation graph, then I'm likely to have deadlock. In particular, if I think of this truly as waiting, doing nothing else but wait, then I do have deadlock, assuming nobody else can also free my resources. And so finding deadlock in the resource allocation graph is a process of running a cycle detection algorithm on this graph, which means that whoever allocates the resources and notices the request for them has to update the graph and run a cycle detection algorithm every time somebody goes to the graph to find out if there is a cycle and if we are in a state of deadlock. We talked some about this before. We're going to talk about how to react to it now, though. So, thoughts, comments, questions, anything I should clarify about this material from Friday? Okay. What can I do when I detect a cycle, when I detect a deadlock of my resources? What are the options available to my system? There's a handful of things we could do. The first thing is we could kill a task, an agent. This is a fairly extreme model, okay? But I could just pick one of the agents and destroy them, cause them to vanish, and whatever resource they had allocated now becomes free, okay? When we think about these as being philosophers sitting around a table, this becomes homicide. If we think of them instead as processes running on our computer, this just means some program terminates, which is not what whoever ran that program wanted to happen, but it means the other programs in theory can keep running, assuming that was a necessary program along the way. And so we could pick any agent we want on this cycle and kill it, cause it to release all of its resources, and hope that we don't enter another deadlock state. Okay? We can do this, fairly extreme, but has the advantage of requiring no kind of cooperation from any of the systems. If we have the ability to kill agents to cause them not to exist anymore, then this can work, regardless of how they were programmed. We could cause a wait instruction to fail. So the thing that asked to wait on the resource, the usual model we think of, when we think of, for example, locking some sort of monitor, the understanding of the normal API is this will wait until the monitor becomes available, then acquire it and continue. But we could make this return some sort of Boolean. We could say it's going to sort of return a got it or told no kind of status. If we do that, and if the people that are writing the code are correctly checking the return values of the locks, then when we detect a cycle, we could pick one of those waiting arrows, one of those arrows that is waiting on a resource, where an agent is pointing to a resource they want, and we could get rid of that one edge by telling the agent their wait request has failed. They have been denied the resource, okay? And so this is a less aggressive way of, once we detect deadlock, undeadlocking. It doesn't guarantee that the agent won't immediately re-request the resource and re-enter deadlock. But we hope that if we pick resources and make them unwait, we will eventually, in sort of the randomization of scheduling, enter a new situation which doesn't deadlock. Which I guess is also what we hope when we kill an agent. We hope that the remaining agents won't re-deadlock, that what we have done has succeeded. However, there's much more chance of this getting back stuck in a loop, getting stuck in some sort of live lock situation where we enter deadlock and kill it and enter it and remove it and enter it and remove it. than with killing an agent, because there's when an agent is gone, the agent is gone. That agent can't play again. And eventually we'll guarantee the end of deadlock by having only one agent left, which won't allow resources to exist in this graph. We don't have such a guarantee when we just remove edges by making them fail, depending on the behavior of the agents. So it's something, but it isn't a great solution. And this is basically it. There really aren't a lot of other options here. Adding new resources theoretically could help, except the agents need to know the new resources exist, and particularly when the resources are things like locks, we can't just arbitrarily introduce new ones without breaking how the program works. And so unless our agents are carefully designed to react to the existence of deadlock in an intelligent way, our options for reacting to a detected deadlock are not extensive. We can kill the deadlocking things, or we can tell them they failed, and that's really the set that is at our disposal. And this, combined with the fact that cycle detection is a linear algorithm, that is, say, linear in the number of nodes and edges, which means that for a large number of agents and resources, we can spend significant time doing the detection, means that deadlock detection, while still occasionally the right thing to do, does not have a huge amount of use in common practice today, because there's a fair amount of time overhead, and then the level of control it gives you once you're done is not as high as we might hope. So, and that is sort of summarized here, by talking about, like, all right, we can either pick a thread or remove its resources, or we can make it undo the wait request. And these are essentially the opportunities that we have available to us, is to undo, say you failed, or kill something. Simply releasing resources will allow things to move forward, but will also generate race conditions and the like. So it's not generally considered to be a useful solution. So what we really want to do with deadlock is prevent it entirely. We don't want it to occur. It causes our programs to freeze, and if they so freeze, we don't have a reasonable and desirable reaction to take. So, before I move on to preventing deadlock, any questions about deadlock, what it is, how we detect it, why recovery is bad, anything else I should usefully say about that before we move into the prevention? Okay. When we think about preventing, we can either try to do it statically, that is, say, at compile time, guarantee it can't occur. We can do it dynamically, that is, say, at runtime, guarantee it can't occur. And virtually all, oh, I didn't update this. I shouldn't say your solution's a PA5. I should say your solution's to lab tomorrow. Anyway, virtually all programs that use locks, we hope the programmer did static deadlock prevention. That is to say, we hope the programmer thought carefully about all possible ways the locks could be used and guaranteed the way they were using them assured that there wouldn't be deadlock. And there are various ways of dealing with that. The lab tomorrow will explore a few of them, and you'll be able to sort of see how that works. Sometimes this is tried to be designed at a broader level than a single program. And so there are things like the Java synchronized keyword that are guaranteed that certain kinds of deadlock, like an exception causing you not to unlock something you locked or the like, will become impossible. So we're about certain classes of deadlocks, but not all of those that could exist, meaning that the programmer still has to work, just hopefully a little less hard. You can also try to design an API that prevents deadlock. Either so that you can't get it or that it's unlikely given how people currently use it. One of the most common models here that is deadlock light, shall we say, that's harder to cause deadlock, is called a message passing approach. The idea here is instead of allowing resources to be shared, we give every thread an incoming queue of messages that have been sent. And so all the threads do to talk to each other is put messages in one another's queues, and no other action is taken. And so this can seem to remove all deadlock because the queues don't have deadlock in them individually. We have the situation that appears to have no deadlock. However, we can always design our threads to react to those messages in a way that occasionally causes them to wait for other messages to appear. And so if we react to messages in a way that causes waiting, and we put ourselves back in the situation where deadlock can occur, which means we still have to think about it. So while it's a lot less likelihood with message passing, it's also not guaranteed that it won't occur. There's other reasons message passing is nice, scales up to things like supercomputers and so on, but it's the main one. It's not the only one. Another way of dealing with it is instead of giving access to threads at a programming level at all, we give access to certain like parallel loops and other higher level constructs that are carefully constrained to not have deadlock. And we will have a chance to look at a little bit of that in a future lab as well. That said, although there are some research papers where your compiler will prove there are no deadlocks, I don't know of any implementations of those in production level pipelines. So we hope you remove deadlock, and there's some things we can do to help that out by using them in particular ways, but it's still sort of up to the programmer to stop it in practice. So if we can't do it statically well, we could always try dynamically, meaning at runtime. We could design our library to add a little bit of extra code to the acquire and release functions of resources so that they will prevent deadlock from ever occurring. And the best known algorithm of this is called the Banker's algorithm. So let's explore the Banker's algorithm by example for the dining philosopher's problem. All right, first let's sort of give an overview of what the Banker's algorithm is trying to guarantee and how it's going to reach it. Okay, so we're going to wait more often. The solution the Banker's algorithm and several other dynamic algorithms are going to give is when you request a resource, we're not going to give it to you just because it's available. We're only going to give it to you if it's available and giving it to you can't result in deadlock. Okay, so we're going to wait if deadlock is not impossible. Okay, and I do want to say it's not impossible rather than it's possible. Proving that it's possible for deadlock to occur is an undecidable problem. It's something we can't do in general. However, a superset of all the things where it could occur, an overestimation, can be generated, and the Banker's algorithm is going to generate one such overestimation. The way it's going to figure out if deadlock is impossible is it's going to require a max number of resources per agent. In order to request any resources at all, before you request your first resource, you have to tell the banker, you have to tell this algorithm that's checking your resource allocation, the most you will ever need. Okay, so there's going to be this maximum number of resources, and you're not allowed to change that without releasing all of your current resources first. So once you say, all I will ever need is two chopsticks, you're not allowed to change your mind and say, no, I'll need three. And you're also not allowed to ask for a third chopstick unless you set down all of the ones you have now before making that request. Okay? So then what it's going to do is it's going to track the number of resources each agent has and the number of resources that are unused. Let's think about this as dining philosopher, then we'll get to we'll do a simplified version of dining philosopher, then we'll get to the real thing. Let's suppose I have three agents sitting around a table, and let's suppose I have three chopsticks all in the center of the table. we can think about how this works is we can say the resources that are left is just the number 3. There are 3 resources left. And we can say the maximums is going to be a vector. It's going to be a list of resources. Let's go ahead and number agents so I can do this in a reasonable way. It's going to be a list of resources that each of the agents might need. So I might say that agent 2 might need 2, and agent 1 might need 2, and agent 2 might need 2, and agent 3 might need 2. The maximum set of resources that could ever be needed by the various agents. And I also have the current allocation. Okay, when we start off, nobody has any resources. And then by subtracting current from max, I can have the amount that is left, the amount that anybody could possibly need in the future. So we track this information. And what we're going to need to make sure, we're going to ensure that the next request lets some agent finish. So let's walk through this and see how this works. Let's suppose agent 1 wants a chopstick. What happens if the resource is not identical? I will get to the various kinds of resources here in a moment. We'll start with just one pool of resources. We will get to that though. Okay. We'll also get, maybe today, maybe not till Wednesday, to the case where some agents need more resources than others, and there's some extra rules that will be thrown in there. All right, so agent 1 requests a chopstick. We have 3 remaining, and nobody needs more than 2. So we will just give 1 chopstick to agent 1. We'll say agent 1 now has a chopstick. They need only 1 more chopstick, and there are 2 available. And this is an okay state because the 2 available is enough for actually any one of the 3 agents to get the remaining resources they need. And so because the minimum of this is smaller than that, or smaller than or equal to that, then I know something can succeed. And so then if agent 2 requests a resource, we're going to run through the same sort of logic. We're going to say, agent 2 wants a resource. Can I give a resource to agent 2? Well, that would mean I'd have 1 resource left. That means agent 2 has a resource. And so if agent 2 has a resource, then agent 2 might need 1 more resource. But agents 1 and 2 can still finish. Agent 3 can no longer finish. I have fewer resources than agent 3 needs. But because there's some agent that can finish, in fact, both agent 1 and agent 2 can still get the resources they need to finish, then everything's fine. But if then agent 3 requests a resource, now we're going to have a problem. That would mean there would be 0 resources left, and everybody would need 1 resource. And so because I had fewer resources left than any but the least needy person needs, this is not an okay situation to get into. And so instead of allowing agent 1 to get a agent 3 to get a resource, I would say that agent 3 is waiting on a resource. There's a resource left, but I'm still going to cause agent 3 to wait, because if I didn't make them wait, if I didn't have an extra waiting going on here, then I might enter a scenario where waiting becomes impossible. I might not. Perhaps these maximums were conservative estimates. Perhaps agent 1 actually only needed 1 resource. They just thought they would need 2. But I'm going to be overly conservative here and assume that people will actually need their full maximum to proceed. And so I'm going to refuse to let agent 3 have a chopstick because I've only got 1 left and everybody needs at least 1. But if agent 1 asks for another chopstick, then I'm going to go ahead and give it. Because that would mean I have 0 left, but it would mean agent 1 has 2 and needs none. Because agent 2 needs none, that means I know, sorry, agent 1 needs none, that means I know that agent 1 won't be asking for any more. Because they guaranteed that they only would ever need 1. Only ever need 2, and they have 2 rather. So now I am assured that Agent One will eventually finish their work and return their resources. And so I have entered a situation where all of the resources are allocated, but somebody can finish. And once they finish, more resources will become available. We can increase how many resources available, decrease the current, and so on, and then accept the next request appropriately. So this is the simplest version of the banker's algorithm. Questions about this before we make it more complicated? If an agent represents a process, what would represent a resource in a computing environment? Yeah, so a resource is anything that we don't have an infinite number of. Mutexes, monitors, reader-writer locks, counting semaphores, and so forth would all be examples of resources when we create the resource purely for the purpose of handling synchronization. Other things that might be resources, though, we could think about, for example, most modern computers will have the mouse. Who is allowed to access the mouse input? There might only be, we might say we're only going to let one program react. We might allow everybody program to react. We might also think about things like how much memory is available. If I have if a lot of programs want more memory than's available, who wins? Yes, there's a lot of memory available, but there's a finite amount. And so who wins that argument? I could think about file systems. I might decide that a particular file can only be opened by one agent at a time. Maybe I can allow a couple in, depends on exactly what I'm doing. So anything that we can decide, often we're going to have it 0-1 kind of things. But some of them are going to have this more counting kind of scenario, where we want to allow some but not everybody into the game. We can also think back to that sort of thread idea earlier. If we think of those threads as being resources, you have the processor, and the tasks as being agents, we can design it that way. And so we could say those tasks are all asking for agents. Maybe some of them need multiple. When we're scheduling processes, we might decide this process needs two processors to meaningfully run, because we want to guarantee some sort of timing behaviors or the like. And so we might think of our processors as being resources, of which we have several as well. Other questions? Okay, then let us talk about how this gets a little bit more complicated when we do the actual dining philosophers, when those chopsticks are not all in the same place. So I have an agent one and resource one and agent two and resource two and agent three and resource three. And agent one only wants resource one and resource three. Agent two only wants resource one and resource two, because they're sitting around the table and they're grabbing the chopsticks next to them in this theoretic example. So the resources that are available, I need to consider them as separate from each other. So I'm going to make them a list. I have one resource one, one resource two, and one resource three. And that means that the maximum that's available is going to look like a matrix, where I have an agent one, agent two, and agent three here, and I have resource one, resource two, and resource three here. So agent one might need resource one, might need resource three, but doesn't need resource two. Agent two might need resource one and resource two, but not resource three. Agent three might need resource two and three, but not one. And so I have this matrix of availability. And I also have the same kind of matrix of the current allocations. Currently, nobody has any resources when we start up. We're going to use the same basic concept to make this work. Okay, we're again going to track how many are available, track the sort of the current and so forth. And I guess we have the remaining one of what's left is the other one we track, right? And so this is also just going to be, a vector instead of a matrix. So I just have one of each of them left. And as I go around and allocate resources, right? Agent one wants resource one. So let's consider what that would look. That would mean the ones, I named that weirdly. I shouldn't have named that. I should name this sort of the exists. Okay. So that means that means resource one would be used because we've now given a resource to agent one. It means that agent one now has one resource. Okay. And this would be how our system would change. I see what I did wrong. It wasn't this. I made a stupid mistake here. Sorry, and I detected my mistake and detected it wrong. Let's go ahead and call this back to the ones that are available. Okay. But this shouldn't be the resources is left. This should be the requirements that are left, the requests that are left. So this would now be 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 1, 1. The same as the maximum they'll need minus the ones they have. Let me be consistent in coloring here. Okay. Now the question is, can any of the agents complete? I'm only allowed to do this if at least one agent is able to complete. Notice I have 0 of resource 1 left. So that means that agent 2 cannot complete their work. Agent 2 needs 1, but there is only 0 there. So at this moment, agent 2 is not believed to be able to complete. But agent 1 and agent 3, I still do believe they can complete because the remaining things they need exist. So then let's suppose agent 2 wants resource 2. Agent 2 wants resource 2. And so I'm going to sort of imagine a world where agent 2 has been given that resource and check to make sure some agent can complete. Oh, I should finish this up, right? So I now have only the third resource available. Agent 2 needs the first resource, it's not available. Agent 3 needs the second resource, it is not available. But agent 1 could still theoretically complete. And so I'm still okay giving resource 2 to agent 2. Even though agent 2 now no longer could complete, agent 1 I still believe can. Since somebody can still complete, I'm still in an okay situation. Now if agent 3 were to request resource 3, we would again sort of run this hypothetical. We'd say, okay, what if there were 0 resources there, a resource there, needed none left? And now I would see, oh dear, all 3 of my agents are unable to complete. Because no agent would be able to complete if I served that goal, then I'm not going to do it. I'm instead going to force agent 3 to wait on that resource instead of giving it to them. Because although it's there, somebody else will need it in order to guarantee everybody completes. But then again, when agent 1 requests the resource, we'll run through that sort of hypothetical of figuring out what's going on and try out allocating that resource to agent 1. And when we do, we'll realize, we are still able to have agent 1 complete, so everything is fine. We'll allow agent 1 to grab both chopsticks and proceed about their work. And when agent 1 returns chopsticks to the table, other agents will be able to proceed. And so although we have more complicated math, we're going to need whole vectors and matrices and so on, the same basic principle will still work of the banker's algorithm in this case as well. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Got lab tomorrow. It will actually be happening on Discord instead of Zoom, and we'll send out some more information about why and how of that soon. If it hasn't already come out, theoretically, my TAs will send it out. And then when we come back on Wednesday, we will look some more at sort of the extra strange cases of the banker's algorithm and then how and why it might be used in practice to conclude up our conversation of deadlock. I apologize again about the many errors in the quiz, and we'll look back over a few of those things you raised about that. But thank you all for your time, and I will see you on Wednesday.